This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. As the M23 rebel group continues to tighten control on Goma, a city in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, we look at who they are and what might be their long-term strategy.
The M23 today re-emerged in 2021 as a way for that community to protect itself, but also for Rwanda to project its influence into the Eastern Congo.
Also, can you really party and have a good time without alcohol? One businessman in Ghana thinks so.
It's just like a regular traditional bar. There's music, there's light. You know, the idea really is to have social space that young people especially can go to without even, you know, thinking of alcohol or being pressured to include alcohol.
It's Wednesday, January 29th. We begin with matters concerning the US and Africa. Around the world, humanitarian assistance programs are being forced to fire staff and slow down operations following the suspension of funding by the US, pending a review of all aid programs as ordered by President Donald Trump. Only emergency food programs and military aid to allies, Israel and Egypt, were initially exempt. This freeze is part of a broader halt on foreign aid lasting at least 90 days. It affects the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, PEPFAR for short, which is a global health program that provides money for anti-HIV programs. It is credited with saving over 25 million lives around the world, including many in Africa. Experts fear that the shutdown could result in disruption of treatment for those living with HIV, with increased risks of transmission and emergence of drug-resistant strains as a consequence. I've been speaking with Dr. Krutika Kupali, an infectious diseases expert, who began by sharing her thoughts on the actions of the U.S. government.
I think that the executive order is concerning. If they were going to do this, they should have given some notification so these programs could appropriately prepare, and that has not been given. So it's cutting aid without any transition plans or disregard for the millions of people whose lives depend on it.
Are we clear on the exact reason why the U.S. government has decided to cancel financing for aid? And like you're saying, it seems to be with immediate effect. It sounds a bit harsh.
Yes, I agree that it is harsh, and the exact reasons are still unclear. I think some of the reasons that have come out, they include domestic budget constraints, a reevaluation of foreign aid effectiveness, and just some ideological opposition to certain initiatives, such as those related to reproductive health or global health equity.
Let's try to unpack that impact now, because the president's emergency relief plan for AIDS relief, this is an anti-HIV program, commonly known as PEPFAR, is among those included in this freeze. What impact is this likely to have, especially in Africa?
Since its inception in 2003, PEPFAR has invested over $110 billion globally, with a significant portion allocated to Africa. In recent years, that has been about $6 to $7 billion, and it supports HIV prevention, testing, treatment and care programs across many African nations. These investments have saved over 25 million lives and played a crucial role in preventing mother-to-child transmission, reducing new infections, and ensuring access to antiretroviral therapy.
There would be many wondering if that money can be raised through other means and other organizations with this freeze in place.
PEPFAR alone contributes about $6 billion annually and represents a significant portion of the global HIV/AIDS funding. So it's unlikely other organizations could mobilize such a large amount of money in the short term. And the U.S. doesn't just provide funding, but also facilitates global coordination, logistics, and technical expertise, which is important when it comes to fighting HIV. So replicating this infrastructure would require time, resources, and again, significant contributions against multiple stakeholders. I also think many governments and organizations are already stretched thin due to competing priorities, including post-COVID-19 recovery efforts, inflation, and other global crises. I think it will be important to look at other governments that could fund. So places such as the EU may increase contributions, but we will need to have political will in order for that to happen.
And this freeze is supposed to last for at least 90 days, but is there hope that something could happen and it's lifted sooner? For example, could it be challenged, and who can do that?
It is a possibility it could end sooner, and that depends on a number of different factors. So the freeze could be shortened if policymakers face significant pressure from stakeholders such as international partners, advocacy groups, or members of Congress. I also think other governments and organizations that rely on U.S. funding may advocate for a quicker reversal, and that could always help. Members of Congress who oppose the freeze can introduce legislation or amendments to try and restore funding, but this would require bipartisan support. If the freeze violates specific laws or agreements, there could be legal action to challenge its legitimacy. And I also think public and international pressure from non-governmental organization, global health experts, and affected countries could influence the administration to reconsider.
Dr. Krutika Kupali, an infectious diseases physician in Dallas, Texas, in the United States of America. Now, according to the World Health Organization, as of 2023, there are about 25.6 million people living with HIV in the African region. Health ministries and NGOs across Africa are working out how best to respond to the freeze in the U.S. aid spending. And that is the case with James Kamau, the CEO of Kenya Treatment Access Movement in Nairobi. James is a health activist living with HIV and has been sharing his journey with us and the current reality that the country faces with the lack of U.S. funding for patients affected by the virus. Now, you'll hear the use of the following terms which you might be familiar with, ART and ARV. Antiretroviral therapy, ART, is a combination of medications that treat HIV using antiretroviral drugs, ARVs. ART is a lifelong treatment that can reduce the risk of HIV transmission and improve the quality of life. Here is James.
I'm now going to 34 years HIV positive, but I started activism and advocacy from a very long time. I actually started when the epidemic had just started, and we wanted to make sure that interventions come in, and where the International Treatment Preparedness Coalition, of which I'm a member, and the Pan-African Treatment Access Movement, of which I'm a founding member, was formed. So we were able to push and drive for treatment and for bringing down the cost of ART, and more so doing what you call treatment literacy for people to be able to understand why they need to take ART and also why they need to maintain.
So this organization that you lead, the Kenya Treatment Access Movement, tell us more about it and what kind of work you're involved in, and whether it is an organization that also gets a bit of funding from the U.S. through PEPFAR or any other aid program.
Yes, we do get funding from PEPFAR. They give us money where we do specific advocacy issues to deal with the current situations, especially on issues like laws and regulations that need to be changed, issues of including budget from the National Treasury in Kenya, how they increase funding to it, and what it goes on.
Tell us what you're thinking in terms of, you know, these cuts that the American government is announcing. Do you think they're going to affect HIV treatment programs in Kenya?
Oh, yes, they are going to affect treatment programs in Kenya. The biggest donors is Global Fund and PEPFAR, which bring in the ARVs and the technical work, which includes not only medicines and equipment and reagents, but also funds about over 100,000 doctors, nurses, and clinicians and technical lab people. Luckily, from last year, we had envisioned a day like this or a time like this, and we had started what you call a transitional roadmap, which is supposed to show the government of Kenya putting in funding gradually so as to be able to take over. The big source of funding should be domestic, like in South Africa, where nearly 90% of all ART is from the South African government. Right now, we have about 1.1 million people on ART, and we need to continue.
As far as US goes, it still does look like we are all trying to understand what exactly will be affected and to what extent. But since the executive order was signed and the government in the US has been talking about reducing or stopping all aid programs across the world for now, has there been any initial impact of that in Kenya so far, or how has the situation been?
What will affect us is now the services. We have quite a number of people who are paid by either PEPFAR or the CDC. That includes doctors, nurses, clinicians, laboratory technicians, etc., who will lose their jobs and who have, most of them, also been asked to go on leave. But if it continues, the commodity will come in.
Do you see any impact, longer-term impact, of the decisions by the U.S. government?
Yes. One, PEPFAR, if you look at it, it is called Presidential Emergency. Please put brackets on emergency. So it is not there permanently.
Right.
And that's number one. Number two, as a Kenyan American, it's not authorized or does not have the power to look after me. The person who needs to look after me is my country. And I've been pushing for what we call sustainable transition framework for takeover. And I think this was a kick in the rear of reality of what we in Kenya and we in Africa have always ignored, because Big Brother is there. Not forgetting that we are the most affected on our planet by HIV, and we need to have been putting more effort on it.
What's been the reaction from people living with HIV in Kenya, specifically to the events happening now?
A lot of people have fear. They know, the common man and woman who takes the drugs knows what it does, and they are able to go about their daily bread and be able to work. So that is going to be the biggest fear of the people. They are afraid of what it will entail, especially the fact that even before we've had stockouts, there's been a hue and cry. Also, we've been able to keep people away from hospitals with opportunistic infections and any other. And with the lack of ARVs or the funding thereof, in the beginning, before we actually started making use of ARVs, where we were pushing for it, in some places we had bed occupancy for HIV-related illnesses up to 50%.
Do you fear that could happen?
First of all, there's no choice. In fact, if you ask me, one of the things that the Trump administration has done is giving our leaders the reality check of what has been there and what is there. And I think the lesson we need to have learned is the devastation of what COVID did when it found the governments flat-footed. And I think that is why the presidents are meeting. But if you ask me, this should have started years ago.
Many thanks to James Kamau in Kenya.
That's a sound of events from late last weekend when the rebel group M23, or March 23rd Movement, fought their way towards the city of Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. At the other end of the fire are the Congolese army and other allied militia who are keen to keep the city under the control of government. It is what many see as a key moment in a conflict that has lasted for more than three decades, with ethnic interests, mineral wealth and geopolitics at the center of it all. If you've been following this story and wondering who the M23 are, what they want, and why Rwanda, the neighboring country, keeps getting thrown in the mix, then this is a story for you, because I posed those questions to Jason Stans, a professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. He lived in DR Congo for nearly 10 years and has also written on the conflict there.
Since 1996, Rwanda and Congo have been in very conflictual relations. And so the M23 today reemerged in 2021. Backed by Rwanda and emerging in particular out of the Congolese Tutsi community of the Eastern Congo, which of course is also present in Rwanda, as a way for that community to protect itself, but also for Rwanda to project its influence into the Eastern Congo.
In a nutshell or something like that, what is it that they really want?
What they actually want is a bit difficult to discern. The M23 is very heavily backed by Rwanda. The sum of at least half of its fighters are probably from the Rwandan government. Around 5,000 Rwandan troops are present in the Eastern Congo. What Rwanda wants is, of course, difficult to know because it's secret. But Rwanda, over time, has, again, over the last 30 years, has again and again backed armed groups in the Eastern Congo for security purposes to fight Rwandan rebels in the Eastern Congo, but also to project influence and to control the part of the Eastern Congo to extract resources. Last year, for example, Rwanda exported $1 billion of minerals. Much of that is assumed to come from the Eastern Congo. And so it's a mixture of things for the Rwandan government and for the M23 rebels.
The Rwandan government, though, denies all these allegations that they are involved with the group. They fund them. We don't have any latest on in terms of what they are saying since the group started getting into the city of Goma. But before that, the government of Rwanda has denied any involvement.
Yes, I mean, there's been six reports from the UN group of experts. It's an investigation body by the United Nations. All of these have documented extensive Rwandan support. This comes in terms of troops, but also armored personnel carriers, surface-to-air missiles, drones. There are pictures, there are videos. The United States State Department has confirmed this, and many governments have denounced this support. So I really don't think there's any question about Rwanda's support anymore to the M23.
At what point in the life cycle of this group do they get entangled with the government of Rwanda? You know, that being the allegation that they are involved with the government. So at what point did that happen?
So in the fall of 2021, the Ugandan army, which had very tense relations with the Rwandans at the time, launched military operations into the Eastern Congo. And the Rwandan government was worried that they would use that to destabilize Rwanda. At the same time, to the south of Rwanda, Burundi was also sending its troops into the DRC to collaborate with the Congolese government there. And so Rwanda saw itself surrounded on all sides, and it initially backed the M23 as a way to protect itself, to project influence, to stem the advances of those other troops. But of course, over time, its interests have shifted. And so the M23 emerged as a way to protect itself against these other forces. But now I think is a much more long-term vision of what Rwanda wants to do in the Eastern Congo. They are burning administration papers wherever they go. They're issuing birth certificates. They're setting up a parallel administration and tax gathering system. I think that Rwanda and the M23 are in this for the long haul.
How much of their mission do you think has to do with the minerals that you talked about, or even protecting the Tutsi community in the DRC?
Well, Rwanda has said, Rwanda sends mixed messages. Rwanda has said on the one hand that they're not present in the Eastern DRC, but it has said the M23 has legitimate grievances, and the M23 is trying to protect the Tutsi community, especially against the FDLR, who are Rwandan rebels, some of whom participated in the 1994 genocide. I think what's important to clarify is that there is not much evidence that there was a rise in hate speech or any collaboration between the Congolese army and the FDLR in the immediate time before the M23 was formed. Of course, there is discrimination against the Congolese Tutsi community in the Eastern Congo. That's a sad reality. But there wasn't an uptick in that right before. There wasn't an imminent threat right before the M23 rebellion. Instead, what we saw is that it was a consequence of the M23 rebellion. You saw an uptick in hate speech and victimization of the Tutsi community. And then also, as so many times before, when faced with a Rwandan-backed rebellion, the Congolese army then resorts to collaborating with Rwandan rebels, the FDLR. And so Rwanda is right. It just gets the order reversed to a certain extent in terms of what happens. So that I think, is the justification Rwanda puts forward. I think that the reality is much more one of power and control. For the last 30 years, Rwanda has always consistently wanted to control part of the Eastern Congo. Part of that is to fend off security threats. Part of it is definitely economic. Part of it is also a way of managing own dissent within Rwanda. It is easier to run an authoritarian government, to repress dissent within Rwanda, if there is an imminent threat, especially if that imminent threat has to do with the genocide, which is really a foundational element in Rwandan society. The genocide undergirds everything in politics and society in Rwanda still today.
There's been a lot of peacekeeping efforts in Eastern DRC. Why is it not bearing fruit?
I think the reality is that the UN peacekeeping missions, no matter where they are, they have the greatest impact if they're deployed in the context of a peace process, a political process, where people get around the table, they talk peace, they demobilize. The UN is not very good at peace enforcements, sending in troops to conduct counterinsurgency operations. And unfortunately, what the reality is today of the UN peacekeeping operation is there is no peace process. There's no political process that they could shepherd through. And instead, they're confined to what they do worst, which is protecting civilians in imminent danger and carrying out counterinsurgency operations. Peacekeepers from Bangladesh and Pakistan and Senegal don't want to send their troops overseas to come back in body bags. And so it's very difficult for them to enforce just a purely military mandate, but that's what they're doing today. And I think that is the reason that they've had such little success. What the Congo really needs is a comprehensive peace process to deal with all the variety of problems and all the different armed groups they have today in the Eastern Congo.
That's Jason Stans, a professor and writer at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Now, Rwanda has in the past consistently denied that it supports the M23 rebels, despite experts at the United Nations accusing Kigali of providing weapons, logistical support, and even commanding the rebels. A statement by the Rwandan government on Sunday did not explicitly deny that it backed the M23, but instead said that the fighting near its border was a serious threat to its security and territorial integrity. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Picture this, a lively night out in Accra, Ghana's vibrant capital. The music's pumping, the dance floor is alive, and everyone's having a time of their lives. But here's the twist, there is not a single drop of alcohol in sight. That's a kind of experience one would have at Eden Bar, which, according to its founder, John Asogonde, is Ghana's first non-alcoholic bar. John started it in 2022. So we caught up with some people at the bar.
It's not like the number one preference.
100%. I mean, you are in control of your state, your being.
I can go to a party that's... there is no alcohol at all.
Whether I'm sober or not, just for fun. If I have that fun, it's okay.
John's business rides on sober curiosity, a new trend among young people that's advocating for alcohol-free lifestyles all around the world. He's been telling me what inspired the idea.
I started Eden Bar as a place that I wanted to visit myself. After I quit drinking in 2018, I realized that there weren't enough spaces for me to socialize or just hang out without the pressure of alcohol. So Eden Bar was basically something I wanted for myself, and I found a community that also wanted something similar. Much like everybody else, I started drinking out of peer pressure in secondary school. The first time was just experimenting. Then I became an occasional drinker, so that's like recreational once a while. And then I got into the abuse, probably addiction, because it got to a point where I would drink every day. But by God's grace, I was able to come of it. I started to turn my life around and also decided to help other people out there who may be struggling with the same sort of addiction.
Okay. What was the turning point for you?
I realized that my life wasn't going in the direction that I wanted it to go. I had big ambitions growing up as a kid, but at this point, my life became really miserable. I would party out, be on social media, being the loudest guy out there. But anytime I got back home and I was by myself, I realized how empty my life was. I realized how miserable my life was. And so I decided that something had to change. Leaning on my faith, I think God's favor and God's grace played a major role as well. But I just had to, you know, take that bold step to turn my life around because I wasn't happy with, you know, the situation I found myself in. And that's how it started.
And now you're coming in with this business, a bar where there's no alcohol. Before you tell us how that fits into the culture that you've described, how does that look like?
on a typical Friday night?
It's just like a regular traditional bar. There's music, there's lights, there's a cocktail bar, we have food. And, you know, the idea really is to have social space that young people especially can go to just to unwind, just to socialize without even, you know, thinking of alcohol or being pressured to include alcohol.
I'm wondering if there is any challenges involved with running a business like this, which more or less could be challenging a culture of what it is like to go out.
I mean, I've been someone who always wants to challenge the status quo. Since I was young, I would always speak against things that are not right in the community. And so when we first started the idea, there were a lot of people on social media that said it was not a reasonable idea to even have a bar like that in the first place. But we proved them all wrong by just, you know, going ahead to do what we believed in. And fortunately, it's a culture that is also growing across the world. People are realizing that alcohol is indeed not really helpful. And so with places like Eden Bar, we can sort of change the narrative around what it means to socialize or to drink.
John Asogonde in Ghana. My colleague, Muthoni Mushiri, has been studying the drinking culture in Ghana and whether the idea of alcohol-free bars can really take off. Take a listen to what she told me.
In general, alcohol consumption in Ghana is really deeply intertwined with what I'll say is the culture and a lot of the social life, as is across of Africa. They have a lot of traditional brews. It's like a strong palm wine kind of sugarcane drink, and that's drank a lot in ceremonies, in weddings, in funerals, a lot of their rites of passages, things like that. But that's more in traditional settings. But especially in the urban areas like Accra, you know, the main cities, they drink a lot of beer and wine more for casual consumption. So that's really what takes over the market in more urban settings. I wouldn't say Ghana is one of the leading alcohol consumers in Africa. There's some stats that show that Uganda is top in Africa. But in Ghana, again, about 30% of the men drink alcohol and about 13% of women. So the numbers aren't as high, but there is a lot of still like alcohol consumption happening.
Mm. You know what I find interesting is almost every country in Africa think they drink the most, and then statistics come
it's
and
true.
Say, hey, it's actually another country.
It's true. I would have thought it was Kenya or maybe South Africa, but yeah. It's Uganda.
But there's research as well that's showing that the Gen Z are drinking less. Do you know why that is the case?
I think they're just rewriting how they consume alcohol. First of all, there's health reasons, but I think that generation, Gen Zs, are hyper aware. This would come from being on social media. They spent a lot of their time facing content that shows them, you know, the effect of drinking, you know, long liver term like damage, mental health, things like that. So the first thing I would say is definitely to be more health conscious. But I think also when it comes to drinking alcohol, it costs a lot as well. So a lot of Gen Zs are seeing that there's some financial implications and it can be expensive. But I think the biggest reason that I've seen is more of just a cultural shift in general. There's the trend, I don't know if you've heard about it, it's called being sober curious. So you're saying, okay, I'm not going to drink, you know, this weekend, I'll drink only once a month and things like that. So I think with sober curious movements, especially on the continent, it can be tricky because a lot of the establishments haven't really adapted to the level that I would say someone like John at Eden Bar in Ghana has. I think that as we get more conscious about our health, to try and see how we can cut back, what we can do to improve our health, these venues and, you know, these locations, or even just maybe a location you normally go to, having a menu that is purely non-alcoholic, as opposed to a small section in the bottom of a menu, can help with the movement. I definitely think there'll be pushback. I mean, you know, probably bigger campaigns to show, or maybe you'll see that these companies will then start adapting. Like they'll make their version of alcohol and they'll make the same version without alcohol just so to keep that clientele that they have, so that if, you know, if you and I, for example, go and have a drink and I'm having non-alcoholic, then I don't have to then say we have to go somewhere else. We can still go to the places that we're familiar with. So it depends really on how they adapt and how they manage that.
The BBC's Muthoni Mushiri. Focus on Africa was put together by Frenny Joey in Nairobi with Yvette Twagira-Maria and Bella Hassan in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer in charge of all our efforts. Chris Kuzaris, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. our sister podcast Africa Daily's latest edition asks the question, will the victims of apartheid violence see justice in South Africa? I'm Charles Gitonga. Thanks for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.